Life, Government, Science.
Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Recently, the coronavirus has spread from China to the U.S. and beyond. The World Health Organization has declared the coronavirus outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. In addition, there are two strains of the flu circulating in the U.S., which have already killed over 26,000 people. Given the bugs around us, many people wonder, what can we do to protect ourselves? The good news is we can strengthen our immune system naturally. Our guest today is here to tell us ways we can strengthen our immune system naturally. Dr. Emily Telfair is a naturopathic doctor who practices in the Baltimore, Maryland area. She earned her doctorate of naturopathic medicine from Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Emily supports individuals and families in taking an active and mindful approach to their health through health education and natural therapeutics. While serving as president of the Maryland Naturopathic Doctors Association, Dr. Emily was instrumental in passing legislation in 2014 to license naturopathic doctors in the state of Maryland. Dr. Emily Telfair, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, I so appreciated learning from you at a seminar you did recently in the Baltimore area, and I was eager to share what you know with our listeners, so I really appreciate you being here today. Why don't we start, for listeners who may not know much about naturopathic medicine, can you explain what is a naturopathic doctor and how is that training different from a traditional, what we would think of as a medical doctor?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. So naturopathic doctors are licensed healthcare professionals who do complete a four-year graduate degree and attend a naturopathic medical school. There are four naturopathic medical schools accredited in the U.S. and two in Canada. And the training really emphasizes disease prevention and really taking a role as a naturopathic doctor in empowering our patients to really take an active role in their own health care. And we do this by using natural therapeutics whenever possible to help stimulate healing and vitality. So there's a kind of core overlap between naturopathic medical training and that of a traditional Western medical doctor or osteopathic physician, in that we're all trained in the basic medical sciences and learning basic diagnostic techniques, laboratory testing, and additional testing when needed. But the difference is that naturopathic doctors really begin with a fundamental belief that the body is designed to move in a healing direction. And when we can remove the obstacles to cure or kind of provide support to improve someone's vitality, that the body can heal itself. And it doesn't mean that we're opposed to use of pharmaceuticals or having surgeries when needed, because certainly those have a time and place in medicine. It's just that there are many places we can begin, and I think our discussion today will illustrate that.
Yeah, I think that's great. And in some ways, we're kind of going back to some ancient wisdom. I mean, before there was the Western medical practice, there was a lot of natural healing. That's a lot of what the midwives would do and the herbal treatments women would provide for their families and communities all through the ages. So I'm delighted to see kind of a resurgence of the recognition of how much value there can be from some of these natural medical treatments. So thank you for getting the training and learning more about all this so you can help all of us be healthier. Let's go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying that it's going to be kind of like waking back up some wisdom that has many people even have learned from their grandparents or that they learned from their parents, that this isn't new information in many ways, but it's kind of a remembering of what's been true for a very long time.
Right. Fantastic. So I began the hour here by talking about the coronavirus and the flus that are circulating right now. And I know a lot of people are very concerned about it. I know actually a lot of people are concerned about the coronavirus, even though your chances of getting the flu are actually much more, it's much more likely you're going to get hit with that. But are there factors that make certain people more susceptible to getting these kinds of respiratory illnesses?
Yes. Well, we see often, especially with cold and the flu, and I'm even seeing in my own practice now that we're on the other side of the holidays, that coming through a period of stress, whether it be the busyness that the holidays can bring, being with family, just that sometimes it's students finishing their exams, having come through that type of stress. And even those who are recovering from a past illness, that can really suppress the immune response. So sometimes we can kind of get through that stressful experience healthy, thankfully, but it may be a week or two later after the immune system kind of adjusts and is kind of feels the impact of that on the body that someone might actually develop an illness or particularly a viral infection. And the dietary choices can really influence our susceptibility. Overuse of alcohol, sugar, caffeine, all of those can stress the body in a way that can impact our susceptibility and weaken our body's ability to fight off an infection we might be exposed to. And something else I'm seeing is that because a lot of individuals are managing chronic health conditions, particularly mm-hmm. autoimmune diseases, now in our modern era, that there are people on immune suppressive medications, whether they be biologics or also a lot of steroid use. And whereas, again, those medications may serve an important purpose and support that individual, they can also impact their susceptibility to getting these viruses and other infections that are circulating this time of year.
Right. So what can we do now, you know, for the average person here, what can we do to take some action to prevent getting some of these bugs? Because we know we're exposed to these bugs all the time. The key is, you know, whether we're susceptible or whether our body is strong enough to fight off these infections that are out there. So what can we do to prevent getting these colds and flu and things like that?
Oh, well, this is where I get quite excited to be able to discuss some of these everyday wellness practices that people can really implement because they're often left out of a discussion about cold and flu prevention, at least from what I hear on the radio or TV programs where it kind of ends at hand washing. And yes, hand washing is important, so please, please do keep that in your prevention plan. But aside from that, I really like to start with the foundations of health. And in naturopathic medicine, this is kind of a great place to begin for any kind of wellness practice, starting with really good sleep hygiene. You know, getting that 7 to 8 hours of sleep and prioritizing that can make a world of difference for allowing the immune system to become more resilient because there's so much healing and repair that happens when we're resting. Good hydration to help the body flush out and release toxins can also improve our ability to prevent disease. And just even eating regular meals throughout the day. I see a lot of people who do not eat regular meals. which can help keep the blood sugar level more in balance, which prevents unnecessary spurts in cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and we can help keep inflammation more at bay. Also, regular exercise, that can't be understated. And this isn't necessarily telling everyone to go out and train for a marathon by any means, because that can be a little more stress to the immune system. But regular, 20 to 30 minutes, 3 to 4 to 5 times a week, can be wonderful for improving circulation, also allowing for perspiration to help the body detox. And I also recommend wearing a hat and scarf. It may feel like an old wives' tale to tell people to cover their neck and the top of their head. But in Chinese medicine, there's something called the Wei Qi. That's spelled W-E-I. And that is the part of our vitality that helps to kind of fend off infection. And when we can get cold, or particularly the back of our neck gets exposed to a chill, it can actually shift our body in a way to become more susceptible if we get exposed to, a viral particle, to then actually get sick. So it's probably not going to hurt anything to wear a hat and scarf, and it could be a nice form of protection.
So my mother was right all these years.
Yes, indeed. And then we don't see the sun as much during the winter months, at least in the part of the world that I live in. And vitamin D, taken as a supplement, can help kind of balance that vitamin we normally would get from the sun and our bodies would make from sunlight. And taking it as a supplement can also be a helpful immune boost.
That sounds great. Well, those are all sensible, doable things. Now, you mentioned eating regular meals during the day. I've heard different advice on that. Like, some people say you should just eat a lunch and a dinner so your body's not processing food all the time. What is your research showing? Is you think we should be eating like kind of 3 meals a day relatively even, or what's your advice on eating?
Yes, that's a very big question. It probably deserves its own whole show, perhaps. But it really does come down to the individual, and I would be amiss to say that there's one particular eating plan that is best for all. But there is research showing that that if we can keep blood sugar levels more even and prevent a lot of spikes and drops in our blood sugar level, that prevents insulin, which is a hormone our pancreas releases when we're kind of have a big bolus of food come in and our blood sugar rises. We need that insulin to then get the blood or the sugar back into our cells to make energy. But when we have big boluses of food coming in, especially with a lot of carbohydrates or sugar, then we have to make a lot of insulin to counterbalance that. And when we release a lot of insulin at a time, it actually increases the inflammatory load in the body. So just to help keep that at bay, having good fat and protein and avoiding lots of drinks with that can have a lot of sugar in them, like sometimes even those coffee drinks and lattes and mochas and things like that can have a lot of hidden sugar, as well as sodas and juices and things like that. So keeping those at a minimum can actually help keep the blood sugar level more stable, which also leads to feeling more even energy through the day, less anxiety, less getting that hangry feeling, which some people may be familiar with.
Right, exactly. Well, I know my daughter bought this kind of a cold drink. It's a cold coffee thing from Starbucks that she got at the store. And it's this little bottle. And I read it, and it said 44 grams of sugar. I was like, oh, my God, this is like sugar and caffeine water. Just inhaling it. Like, that can't, I mean, it probably does give you a boost of energy, but in the long run, you're probably going to have that sugar drop afterwards, right?
Exactly.
Right. So, well, let's talk a little bit more about the kinds of food we eat, because you have tremendous knowledge about some specific foods, not only eating regularly during the day to keep our blood sugar levels kind of relatively even, but certain foods are going to make us feel better and strengthen our immune system more than others. So What advice do you have for our listeners who kind of want to have that extra boost to our immune system during the cold winter months? What should we be eating?
Yes, well, isn't it nice how, at least here in the Western Hemisphere, I recognize your listeners may be global, but over here, that even the foods that are in season this time of year have a lot of immune supportive properties. So we have here in Maryland, the winter squashes are really prevalent. The foods that are rich in beta carotene, these would be your butternut squash, sweet potatoes, spaghetti squash, and similar foods. And that beta carotene is actually two vitamin A molecules stuck together. And our body, once we take in the beta carotene, will convert it to the vitamin A that we need. And vitamin A even itself has some antiviral properties in our body. And the beta carotene acts as an antioxidant. And anytime you have inflammation going on, which an infection like colds or flus will create a lot of inflammation and free radicals, it just kind of creates a little bit of a organic mess. And the antioxidants help clean up that mess when there's inflammation involved. So that's a great food to keep rich. Carrots would be another obvious source of beta carotene. And another group of foods that I just really adopted back into my diet a few years ago are mushrooms. And I grew up not liking mushrooms and was pretty much only exposed to the traditional button mushroom, which to me didn't have a lot of flavor and certainly didn't like the texture. But of course, being in the field that I'm in, I've been exposed to the fact that mushrooms have tremendous healing capacity for the immune system. They're used for anti-cancer support, and this time of year it can be wonderfully helpful for cold and flu prevention with their beta-glucans, which is one of the constituents in that fungi that help boost our immune response. And this would be all types of mushrooms, but I really encourage listeners to consider diversifying their palate, because as I learned recently, that all the different types of mushrooms have such different flavors, and you can mix them in so many different things, so from reishi to maitake to oyster mushrooms. There's quite a variety, and perhaps each time you go to the grocery store, consider trying something new.
Right, exactly. I was thrilled going to our local farmer's market here in Tacoma Park, Maryland, to just see they have a whole stand on mushrooms, and they have them right in front of you. They're freshly picked, and they have the ones you're talking about, shiitake and maitake and oyster and lion's mane. And, you know, I'm sure each of them, they do have their own flavors. We put them together with a veggie stir fry, and they taste awesome. And, you know, some of them are good for lifting your immune system. Some of them are good for clearing brain fog. You know, they all seem to have their own magical properties. So, yeah, I definitely encourage our listeners to get out there and explore the world of mushrooms. There's some amazing flavors and health benefits from mushrooms.
Oh, definitely. And important note is to eat your mushrooms cooked, that it helps to break down the cell walls and makes them much easier to digest and to get those healing benefits of the mushrooms and their healing properties so that your body can access that. Folks think that with especially produce that sometimes eating it raw may be better, or you may not get the healing benefits if you cook the food, but that's not necessarily the case. And mushrooms are one of those foods that you want to cook, saute, and that'll really, they're pretty simple to prepare, and they can take on great flavor and enhance your meals and make good soups, put them in stews, sprinkle them anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually was friends with the Native American medicine man once, and I called him. I had a flu and was really feeling awful. So I said, well, what do you do? Call your friend the medicine man. So what should I do? And he talked a lot about garlic and onions. And he said, you know, get the chicken soup, get some fresh garlic, you know, pound it up, put it in, maybe even eat a raw onion sandwich. And so tell us what you know about what garlic and onions can do to help us.
Oh, yes. Garlic is one of my first go-tos. If I'm coming down with something, I make a garlic ginger tea. So garlic has great antiviral, antibacterial, even probably antifungal properties. It pretty much will kill most of the things in its path. I think we even did an experiment when I was in medical school in the microbiology lab where we were growing cultures of things and we were putting different antimicrobial agents. And we used garlic and we saw the big spread that of what it cleared in its path because of its antimicrobial properties. So that you can crush the garlic and that helps to release some of those healing agents. But you can also just swallow and chew garlic, or you may not have too much friends by the end, many friends at the end of the winter, but you might be very healthy all the way through. But you can crush the garlic and even steep it in tea and add some honey, because honey has antimicrobial properties as well, and that will add soothing, especially if you're starting to get a bit of a sore throat. And ginger added in there also is anti-inflammatory. But onions, you're right, can be a nice addition. And there is a syrup that one of my old teachers gave us the recipe for. Your listeners might enjoy making this because it probably stands a chance that they have one onion, maybe two cloves of garlic, and some honey in their cupboard. So this would be simple to make. So if you just slice up an onion and then take two slices of garlic, and you can just slice them up as well, and then layer them in a pan, and then pour over about 3/4 cup of honey, and you can saute it for about very slowly for a couple hours on low heat, and then strain it, or you could just leave it in a pot to sit for a couple of days, and all of the medicinal properties of those herbs will go right into the honey, and then you can take the honey a teaspoon a day, or use it as a salad dressing, could be really nice and flavorful. And that could be your tonic for the winter.
Mm, that's great. I love these home remedies, things we can do without even having to go down to the pharmacy there. But and speaking of foods that we might have nearby that can help us, you talked about reducing inflammation. Aren't there fishes that we can eat that will reduce our inflammation?
Yes. So this probably can span even beyond the discussion we're having, but to most health concerns, that there's a lot of benefit to the omega-3 fatty acids that are particularly found rich in cold water wild fish like salmon, sardines, herring. Some of those smaller fish are used a lot for making fish oil preparations. And making sure that they're wild caught, because that will really influence the quality of the, especially if you're taking it as a fish oil, but even if you're eating the fish, the farm-raised are not going to have the same amount of those omega-3 fatty acids. But those omega-3s will actually help mitigate the inflammatory response by supporting the body leaning more into the cell messengers that calm inflammation, versus a lot of the foods in the Western diet will actually kind of cause there to be an increase in inflammation in those types of cell messengers. So it's kind of a balancing dance that's always going on in our bodies. But as we lean more to the anti-inflammatory foods, we can really influence how our cells respond and that calming of inflammation direction.
Right, exactly. And I was talking to the medical doctor, Dean Ornish, the other day, and he was talking about the common problem with a lot of health problems that people have, that we've got inflammation associated with almost every one of them. So, you know, if you look down at the core of a lot of the health issues that people have, this problem of having inflammation in our body is pretty common to a lot of the health issues we're all dealing with. So the things you're talking about, like the wild salmon, the cod, mackerel, the things that can reduce inflammation can help prevent all kinds of health problems.
Oh, exactly. And especially in, you know, the standard Western diet, as I mentioned, is pretty rich in, well, it's very rich in animal products, and that is what particularly helps to push the inflammatory cascade in that direction. And the all pretty much all of, as Dr. Ornish referenced, that all the chronic health concerns that we're really dealing with and they're consuming our healthcare dollars, from diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and now cognitive impairment, such things as or neurocognitive disorders like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, which is also being called diabetes type 3 because it's also related to challenges with blood sugar regulation. So we see this inflammatory cascade just shifting from one organ system to another, and you know, it's a reflection that we're not really getting to the root. Unfortunately, in our healthcare system, it's more management than prevention. But all of these steps and things we're talking about today can be supportive also not just for preventing the common cold or the flu, but also for preventing cancer.
Mm-hmm. Right, and preventing cancer, diabetes, and Dr. Ornish, actually, his new book, for those who haven't heard it yet, is Undo It. And he's saying not only is inflammation and our diet and lifestyle things, exercise, connected to leading to these serious chronic problems that you've mentioned of cancer and diabetes and heart disease, but that even if you have those problems, you can undo it, you can reverse it when you start eating the right foods and moving towards anti-inflammatory and taking some steps for exercise and movement. So he's got a protocol that he follows, which is now available to anyone listening who's in Medicare. If you're 65 or older and eligible for Medicare, that the Dean Ornish program is now available as part of your Medicare treatment. So, you know, a lot of good that can come from what we're talking about are very effective and certainly very cost effective. Now, one of my favorite foods that you talked about we can boost our immune system with is berries. So can you talk a little bit about some of the berries that we could eat that are going to help us be healthier?
Oh, yes. Berries are also probably one of my favorite at this time of year for making sure they're really prevalent in my diet and also as for supplementation. But elderberry is probably the first one to bring to this discussion because there's such a great deal of research showing its efficacy for fighting off viral infections and even being protective against the H1N1 flu. There was some research on that specifically. Hmm. So elderberries, one of those great tonics that can be used throughout the winter season very safely. So listeners may have seen at some of their grocery stores or health food stores elderberry syrups. That's kind of the most common way to consume elderberry, where it's kind of been prepared in either honey or some type of glycerin preparation, where that extracts the medicinal components of elderberry so that it's preserved in the liquid. It's usually really good tasting, so for kids and adults alike. And there'll often be dosing recommendations on, you know, packaging that will keep it in the safe range. But that's one that I definitely use throughout the winter season and all year round, really. And then I also enjoy, like, blueberries are a great one. Those dark pigments that are in berries, for everything from blackberries, raspberries, and the blueberries, that dark pigment is rich in what's called anthocyanins, which is an antioxidant that supports our immune system. And can be wonderful for cardiovascular health. It protects our vessels, so the arteries and veins, it strengthens the vessel walls. So I'll also be using a lot of berries for folks with cardiovascular disorders. And even with chronic respiratory issues like asthma, I like welcoming in those dark pigment berries for the antioxidant benefits, because it can be, asthma is another type of chronic inflammatory condition. And that means if there's a lot of inflammation, there are a lot of free radicals. So you have to send in extra boosters for the cleanup crew so that those products of inflammation are not just sitting there stagnant. We need to bring more hands on deck. And that's where really, as we've been talking about these foods with beautiful colors, that Mother Nature kind of entices us with these colors, to attract us to wanting them to come into our bodies. So the more we're eating the rainbow and seeing that diversity of the leafy greens and the beautiful yellows and oranges of beta carotene and these blues and purples, that we are actually supporting our health at the same time as being delighted by nature.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, you know, we've talked about some of the foods that we can eat and some of the other preventive measures we can take to boost our immune system. Let's talk a little bit more about some of these, the herbal medicines, you know, some of the things that might come out of the flowers, or what are some of the herbs that you see as being effective to helping somebody?
Yeah, so aside from elderberry, which sometimes will kind of be lumped into the herbal mm-hmm. category also, echinacea is probably a very popular one that many listeners may have heard of or may have even seen in gardens. My next-door neighbor grows an echinacea every year, so I see it pop up in the summer, and it looks like a daisy flower. It's known as the cone flower, and it has a bright pink petals, and it's the root of that plant that's generally used for its medicinal properties, particularly for immune support. And this is another herb that has a good amount of research showing its effect on boosting the effect of lymphocytes, which are the white blood cells that really show up to task when we're exposed to a virus. And other aspects of the immune system are also strengthened by this plant. I recommend an echinacea at the very beginning of the onset of a cold or flu. It's going to be more effective at that stage versus when you're 4 or 5 days into it. Or if you notice people in your family or you've been exposed in your work environment that people around you are sick, it's fine to take that for a little period of time just to give your body a boost, just to kind of raise your T-cell activity so that you can, if you are exposed to it, you can fight it off more quickly. I take echinacea when I'm flying, for example. Mm-hmm. I'll bring it in a tincture form, which is another kind of liquid extract, and I'll take it every couple hours, especially if I'm on a longer flight, just to, in case I'm exposed to something on the plane, my immune system will have a boost.
Yeah, that's great. And what about the vitamin C? I mean, a lot of people think you should take vitamin C regularly, or where do you stand on that? Is that something we should take every day, or should we take it when we feel like we're getting sick, or do you think it's effective at all?
Oh, I definitely believe vitamin C is effective. It's another one that shows up for the cleanup crew of antioxidant support in the face of inflammation. And vitamin C is a water-soluble vitamin, so it has a fairly good safety profile. And your body will probably tell you that it's had enough vitamin C if you get some loose stools after maybe a higher dose, or if you've taken it more frequently, and that's your signal to kind of back off and take a bit less. So yes, taking it regularly during especially the cold and flu time, or when you might be exposed to folks who've had an illness, or even on an airplane, it can be a good time to take some vitamin C. And that can be done even a little more frequently if you are sick. So when folks actually have come down with something, I recommend vitamin C every couple hours, again, to that what I call bowel tolerance. Again, your body will tell you when you've had enough, and then you just back it down. But just a general dose of between 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day for an adult is often well tolerated, a bit less for children, and then taking it a bit more frequently if you're sick or feel something coming on.
Right. Yeah, that sounds good. And then, you know, some people get worried about, well, if I take these, they've heard, you know, too much vitamin C or too many vitamins or nutrients that we could kind of muck up our system and cause some problems. Is there a downside to some of these treatments?
Well, it is important to be working with a qualified healthcare professional when you're introducing any kind of new protocol and wanting to ensure that what you're taking is safe for any other chronic health concerns you might be managing. For example, someone who has issues with their liver may be really cautious if they're going to take high doses of vitamin A, because vitamin A is stored in the liver, and it could put a stress on someone who already has some liver toxicity issues. Or if they're pregnant, vitamin A in higher doses could be dangerous for the fetus. So there are. It is important to discuss with your healthcare provider if you're bringing in anything new, especially longer term or at higher doses. Zinc is another one that is often recommended because it can for immune health, because it can help with colds and boosting the immune system when you have the flu or any kind of viral infection. But taking a high dose of 30 to 50 milligrams daily for a long period of time could start depleting a person's copper stores. The copper and zinc balance each other out in the body. And you don't need the same amount of copper supplementation as you do of zinc, but you do need just a little smidge of copper here and there if you're going to take a lot of zinc for a long period of time. So those are the kinds of nuances that could be discussed, especially with a naturopathic doctor if a patient or a person has access to this kind of care, or nutritionist. And I would say that from someone's primary care physician, but the truth is that most Western medical professionals haven't taken extensive training in nutrition. It just isn't woven in traditionally to most medical programs. But hopefully, if their physician has done some of their own research, we'll have some of this information to share as well.
Right, exactly. Well, I recently have been advising a presidential candidate on policy and including on what we can do about health care. And I put into the plan that we would have medical professionals be required to inform patients of some kind of non-invasive treatment that's been scientifically shown to work, whether that be, food or nutrition or exercise, and that sometimes those work better than the drugs or surgery, which is what most medical doctors are trained in. But we need to make sure that the medical professionals are informed about these options. So we need to really kick that up, I think, in terms of the training that medical doctors get so they see more the power of nutrition. And I think there's too much influence of the pharmaceutical industries on the design of the training for our medical doctors, so they kind of get skewed off into drugs and surgery, and leaving aside, some of those can be very valuable and essential and life-saving. But at the same time, there's all this wisdom and possibility of what could be done in a more natural way with food and lifestyle issues. So we want to make sure that those get a hearing also. And, well, you've laid out a lot of possibilities for what we can do here to keep ourselves healthy naturally. What are the self-care practices that you use that you find to be effective?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. Since I work for myself, and it's important for me to stay healthy so that I can give good care to the people that I serve, I do really try to take practice what I preach. Some of the ways I do that are with exercise. I walk to work, which is a good 1.7 miles each way. So that's a nice way to get in some sunshine when it is out, and also get my heart rate and my immune system kicked up that way. I do take an elderberry tonic and some vitamin D supplementation for especially this time of year. I prioritize that. I do get 8 hours sleep, like religiously. That is something I really do not compromise. I really reduce sugar. I think chocolate is my one vice, but overall, sugar is quite low in my diet, as is alcohol. And I have a regular meditation practice, which gives me space during the day to really kind of wind down, to listen to my body and tune in. And I've noticed, and I think I shared this at the seminar that you attended, Eleanor, is that getting sick is not a failure. It doesn't mean that you've done everything wrong and that your body's revolting. Sometimes it's an opportunity to be able to listen and learn. And I did get sick this winter. Just before Christmas, we put my dog down of 15 years, which was very sad. And it was kind of a week leading up to that decision. And even though we were very ready for it and it was really beautiful and peaceful, within 24 hours, I developed a raging sinus infection, which I really understood and felt to be a reflection of the grief. And I really also listened to the fact that my body was trying to slow me down because it was 5 days till Christmas, which can be a very busy time. And I needed some space to really feel and acknowledge what happened. And because there was only phlegm in my head, I couldn't think very well. And I was really forced to be quiet and listen and more still. And so I really appreciated the role that that sinus infection had for me, and I was able to get through it well with my natural therapies. And so there can be this, you know, being able to hold that perspective of how the body is trying to communicate so that when you're on the same team, the healing will actually help happen more quickly.
Yeah, that's great. Well, our bodies are communicating with us all the time if we'll listen. So, by the way, I'm sorry about your dog. That's a big loss.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your condolences.
Yeah. So that's great that you're practicing what you preach here, and the sleeping 8 hours, I'm very jealous. I'm one of those people who, I'm an insomniac, which actually is very helpful when you're working on a presidential campaign. You don't have a lot of time to sleep, but it does have its consequences. So what do you recommend for people who want to sleep those 8 hours, but they have trouble? They'll wake up after like 3 or 4 hours, and then they're kind of up for the day. So what do we do about getting that solid sleep you recommend?
Oh, yes. Well, I do believe a meditation practice can be, even if it's not happening in the evening or right before bed, even if it's happening some other time during the day, it starts to give that cortisol response an opportunity to kind of re-regulate itself, because often one of the disruptors of sleep is just the rev of cortisol and that stress hormone that the body just can't quite wind down. Also, that blood sugar regulation, seems to be a little theme here, can play an important role, because sometimes what triggers people to wake, especially in the middle of the night, can be a dip in blood sugar. So making sure there's adequate protein or maybe a little protein snack before bed can sometimes be helpful. Magnesium is a nutrient that I use, if there was for only five things I could use in practice, magnesium would be one of them, because it's so overarching in its abilities to, whether it's relieving muscle tension or helping to calm some of those excitatory neurotransmitter pathways, which also kind of get keyed up for some folks at night, this kind of second wind that can happen. Magnesium, I like to liken, I call it the let-go mineral. It just helps everything to just let go, let go. I imagine it less whispering to ourselves, like, it's okay, it's time to sleep. So taking some magnesium before bed can be very gentle, often also very well tolerated. It's another one of those nutrients that if you start to get loose stools, that's your body's sign. That was a little bit too much for me, and then tapering it down will often correct that pretty quickly. But for children and adults, it can be pretty miraculous for helping to improve sleep quality. It's not the same as a sedative, but it just helps the things to calm down enough that drifting off to sleep and sometimes staying asleep happens more easily. Now, melatonin is another common sleep aid, and it certainly can be wonderful, especially for people who have trouble falling asleep, but doesn't always help with the staying asleep when that's more of an issue for folks. I have seen in some sleep blends I've started to recommend for certain patients that wake up at night that inflammation can be part of that trigger of waking. They might be folks with chronic pain or chronic inflammatory condition, and that there's this kick up of the inflammatory mediators, and that stimulates waking. So there are some sleep blends that have turmeric, which is a common anti-inflammatory herb, actually added to the sleep blend for that purpose to help relax the inflammation overnight and prevent waking that way.
Well, those are all good steps. And then one of the other reasons people sometimes wake up is they have trouble breathing, so they're not getting enough oxygen. So their body wakes them up going, oh, wait, I need the oxygen or I'm going to die. So No matter how relaxed or peaceful you may be with your life and everything happening around you, if you can't breathe, your body is stressed and wants you awake so you make sure you get the oxygen. What can people do to make sure that they can breathe easier and stay asleep?
Oh, yes. Well, sleep apnea is kind of more where this is kind of falling into that diagnosis category. And certainly getting adequate or proper testing. And if needed, a CPAP machine can be really just tremendously life-changing. I know it has been for my father, for example, and my mother, because now he can sleep back in their same bed without the loud snoring that was happening before. So getting that regulated. But weight loss has been shown to make a real big impact on reducing sleep apnea. Just to take some of that extra tissue to reduce that, which may be causing some compression that then leads to difficulty catching breath. Adjusting pillows and such and getting the right positioning that, to also keep the airways free. And if there is an issue with chronic congestion, allergies and chronic sinus issues also play a role. And I've seen that reducing dairy in the diet, so dairy that's derived from cow, sheep, or goat milk products can often reduce some of that phlegm and congestion, as well as avoiding alcohol before bed can make a big difference as well.
Hmm, interesting. And then there's the old standby with the neti pot or the Nelmed to clean your sinus passages.
Oh, definitely. That's a great one as well, the neti pot, using some kosher salt, which is non-iodized, or sea salt, and some nice warm distilled water can be, if you have access to it, or filtered water can be preferable. That's warmed up a little bit, so it'll be gentler going in your nasal passages. And for listeners who've not heard of the use of a neti pot, it'd probably be best to Google or YouTube a video so you can watch and see how that's done, because you really want a good demo before you do it yourself for the first time.
Right, and that neti, it's spelled N-E-T-I, if you do want to look that up. And then what about nasal sprays? I know the sometimes the doctors want to go right into the steroids, and they're effective, but they're not great to use chronically. So what else could people do about a nasal spray that would not be harmful?
Yeah, so there is one, and this is not an endorsement because I'm not connected to this company in any way, but I've seen it very widely available, called X-Clear. It's X-L-E-A-R, and it's a xylitol-based nasal spray that they have children and adult versions. And I've used a number of different nasal sprays with patients over the years, and this is the one that I've seen the most consistent improvement with, and I've used it myself as well. Xylitol, which some folks may have heard of that as a sweetener that's used in gums and some other types of products. But it has actually antimicrobial properties, a running theme here today, and that when it's squirted into the nasal cavity, it will help to kill off viruses, bacteria. You might taste a little sweetness going down the back of your throat, so that's just a bonus when you use it. But it does, I think I've even seen in some of the ads it has a money-back guarantee, so you can welcome to try it. You don't have much to lose, and that may be helpful if you are sick, so it may help with just fighting off the infection itself while giving you some relief from congestion.
That's great. And, well, you've laid out quite a number of practical steps that we can all take to keep ourselves healthy, or if we're not healthy, to help us get back into balance and feeling good. I'm just wondering, why did you decide to become a naturopathic doctor? It's a kind of an unusual career choice, but you're obviously helping a lot of people with it. So what brought you into that career choice?
Yes, when I was in high school, even looking for, career paths and looking for what I wanted to major in college, I remember being very drawn to biology and psychology and how the mind and body were connected. And I ended up double majoring in college in biology and psychology. But the spirit aspect also really intrigued me as well. And I was probably all of 18 years old when I went on a trip to West Virginia to do some volunteer work, and one of the women in my group was telling me about this school, Bastyr University, and we were discussing our shared interest in the mind-body-spirit connection. And she mentioned the naturopathic medical program, and I'd never heard of it. I was from the Midwest. My mom was a nurse, but we thankfully didn't go to the doctor very often, and I certainly was not interested in becoming a doctor. That involved shots and things I really did not like. But as soon as I learned about what this program offered and the perspective and view it took on health, it just matched everything that made sense to me, even at that fairly young age. And after undergrad, I did do a year of volunteer work in a hospital setting, doing pastoral care. So visiting patients, sitting with them, listening to their stories, saying prayers with them. And that whole experience really solidified that really what I was going to get to do as a naturopathic doctor was just that, to hear people's stories, to be with them and share healing presence in a deep way. And it turns out that's now what I get to do in practice. And thankfully now have the medical knowledge, the knowledge of biochemistry, but also this more view of how nature contributes to our health, and blending that together, I find that people are craving it. They're missing it. It doesn't have a lot of other places to live in their life or where they've been exposed, but yet it's this innate part of us that we want to connect to our own nature. So, and through this journey, I learned to connect to my own as well, and so it's served me personally, and now thankfully I'm able to share it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I noticed you're a graduate of Bastyr University in Washington State, which is, of course, one of the leading centers for naturopathic training. And I was there last year, really enjoyed it, learned a lot. And by the way, did you ever come across this woman, Betty Lynn Brown, who was involved in Bastyr?
Oh, no, I don't know that name.
Yeah, she's an amazing woman out there in the Seattle area. Anyway, how did you find Bastyr? Is that something you'd recommend for listeners who might want to pursue training in natural medicine?
Oh, certainly. Bastyr has a wonderful reputation, as do all the schools, thankfully. I mean, it is an emerging profession. I like to say that rather than small profession, because it is growing. And Bastyr is the second oldest of the current accredited naturopathic medical schools. So it was founded in 1983 with the school that's in Portland, Oregon, National College of Natural Medicine, or actually now it's National University. They have university status now. In Portland is the oldest. That was founded in 1956. So you can see that it's still in somewhat recent history that the profession as it exists now and the training that exists, physician-level training, is still fairly recent, which is why the profession itself is still growing in the becoming licensed in each state. So we still have a little ways to go. But yes, Bastyr is a wonderful institution. They now have a campus in San Diego, California, which is a bit sunnier than the Seattle, Washington campus that I attended.
Right, very good. Well, you know, you mentioned that now the naturopaths are becoming licensed in the state, and you yourself led the charge there in Maryland to help pass the licensing of naturopathic medicine in the state of Maryland. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how many states have licensing now, and what are you up against to get that passed? Was it a big struggle to get that in, or are people kind of welcoming, going, yes, we need some more less intrusive, less expensive, more effective, more humane ways to keep ourselves healthy?
Yes, so when Maryland became licensed, we were the 17th state in the country, with the oldest state having been licensed for 100 years. So it took 100 years for 17 states to become licensed.
Oh, who was the 100-year one?
2014. Yes, Washington State has been licensed
for
the longest. Yes, yes. And now there are 22 states that have passed legislation for regulating the profession of naturopathic medicine. So Maryland, since Maryland passed our law, you know, there's been a nice ripple into Massachusetts and Rhode Island and now New Mexico and Idaho, and I might be in Pennsylvania, has passed some legislation as well, though it's still, theirs is still in the regulation process, so it hasn't been enacted yet. But it's really remarkable to see that how active my colleagues in other states are to kind of push things forward. North Carolina has been working very hard for well over 20 years, and they're getting really close. Michigan has been very active, and they have some activity in that state right now. I'm trying to think of what other state has some a strong push going on. But I'm active in working with the state leaders and other states who are working on the same process that we went through. And in our state in Maryland, it was a tremendous struggle to work with the Medical Society and the Board of Physicians, who were very resistant to us getting regulated. However, it was the actual legislators themselves in Maryland who really took to our issue and understood the benefit it would give to their constituents, and that we weren't here to take away care from any of the other healthcare providers. In fact, we were just here to bring something to the table that didn't quite exist yet, but that people really needed. It's like we were filling a gap more than anything, of a knowledge gap. That, as you mentioned, and I thank you for the progressive perspective you're taking around healthcare education, because it is time, and it's so necessary for more healthcare providers to be gaining skills on the preventative end, and for a healthcare system that will allow time for them to educate patients in that way, because there are only 6,000 of us naturopathic doctors in the country, so we need more people giving similar messaging, to reach and address this chronic disease epidemic.
Yeah, fantastic. And speaking of medical education, health education, can you tell us, you've shared so much of what you know here, and I know you know so much more. What's your website for listeners who want to learn more or get in touch with you?
Oh, thank you. It's heartspacebaltimore.com. So that's the word heart, the word space, and then the word Baltimore.com. And for those who may be interested in starting a meditation practice, under the resources tab, there are two recordings there of 10 to 12 minute meditations that you're welcome to listen to for free, and just have a moment of loving kindness or a nice relaxing body scan meditation.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have. Dr. Emily Telfair, thank you for being with us today, and thank you for sharing your wonderful news, information, knowledge to help us all get healthy and be healthy. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eleanor. I appreciate you welcoming me.